You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Contemporary memoirs are often about life-altering changes and epiphanies, overcoming drug addiction, or reflecting on a damaging childhood. But in The Slippery Year, a meditation on happily ever after, Melanie Gideon examines the everyday small events that made up her life in the year when she was 44. Her book is published by Knopf, and I'm very pleased it has brought Melanie Gideon to our show today. Hello.
Hi.
Did you coin the phrase slippery year?
I think I did. I haven't heard it before.
And how do you mean it to be applied?
Well, for me, the concept of slipperiness or the phenomenon of slipperiness, I think for me it was a year. It was actually a period of years. I feel like I'm still in a slippery year. But I think you could have a slippery moment. You could have a slippery week, a slippery day. But the way I describe it is you are in the process of transformation.
This is different than midlife crisis?
Yeah, because it's not – for me, I had a slippery year. It happened to be in midlife, but I think I've had slippery years in my 20s, my 30s. I assume I'm going to continue to have more of them. But it's any time when you feel the call to change has come for you, but you don't yet know what it's going to look like on the other side.
You've said this is really a book about nothing. But there was a wonderful review in The New Yorker that concluded, by the end of the book, I felt like I had just spent several hours knocking back drinks with an especially funny friend, which is some of my highest praise.
Yeah, that was very lovely.
So how do you think of it? Your subtitle is a meditation, and another description might be a book-length personal essay.
Yeah, you know, my agent and I and my editor went back and forth on this. I don't think of this as a traditional memoir at all, really. It's I think you could read it as a series of essays. I think each chapter kind of stands on its own, but together they do weave this fabric of this period of time of self-examination. I have said, I think in some ways it's a book about nothing, but what I found was that in the nothing was everything. That really meant something.
Well, some reviewers have compared it to Elizabeth Gilbert's Eat, Pray, Love, which is about a woman who tries to transform her life in a year, but she does it after getting a divorce by traveling to Italy and India.
Mm-hmm,
you
yeah.
didn't get a divorce, you didn't do much traveling. What, you went vacation to Maine?
I didn't because, you know, I actually hate to travel. I'm a very nervous traveler. I love it once I get to where I'm going, but the actual travel, the airplane, all that, I hate it. Yeah, for me, it wasn't about having to leave the country or leave my marriage. For me, it was about choosing to stay. That's really what I discovered over the course of the year, that staying was my choice.
But you said that you felt like you were sleepwalking through your life at that point.
I did. I knew. I think that so if I wanted to talk about this in terms of midlife crisis, for me, this was the first time, and nothing drastically bad had happened to me, really. I was living a fine life. I was in a good marriage to a kind man. We had a healthy son. We both had jobs. But somehow I wasn't feeling my life as I was living it. Somehow I had slipped outside of it when I wasn't paying attention. And I knew that if I didn't do something to kind of get myself back in, I might slip out of it for good. So I knew there was a little bit of danger.
Is this partly because the marriage was already established and successful? You talk about marriage changing passion.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, my husband and I have been married for 17 years this September and together for 20. So that's a long chunk of time. And we did have an essentially happy marriage. But I wanted to feel, my love for him more deeply.
And after time, it suggested that sleeping with somebody you've known that long is like sleeping with a relative instead of...
Right. I don't know who said that. It said, marriage changes passion. Suddenly you're in bed with a relative. So that was kind of a big aha for me. Yeah. So I think that's, again, back to this idea of slipperiness that... I needed to jar myself awake to all the bounty of my life.
Did you worry about being too open about your marriage in this book? I'm sure you passed it all by your husband.
I did. I didn't let him really read it until it was completely done. And then I gave him the pages, and I think I sat in the chair while he was reading it on the couch, and I said to him, I handed it to him, and I said, you know, this is a love story. I said, you might not feel that way upon the first read, but it is. And, you know, eventually he came around. He agreed with me.
Well, you say you're embarrassed when he insists on wearing a helmet when he surfs. Some mm-hmm. people might feel reassured.
Yeah, I know. Well, he would like me to tell you that he's no longer wearing the surf helmet unless the waves are really big.
Now, surfing, because you grew up in Rhode Island, uh-huh. but you now live in the Bay Area?
We do, yes. We moved there 9 years ago.
And didn't that offer all sorts of excitement?
Yeah. Without a doubt. We moved there actually from Maine. We had been living in Maine for about 5 years, so that was a really big sea change for us, moving to California. And especially for me, because even being in California for 9 years now, what I know for sure is that I am a New Englander. It's really cemented that for me, that I will never feel like a Californian. I think unlike my son, who I think probably feels like a Californian because he's been there since he was two. But it seems that my ties, my knowing of myself as a New Englander, just gets stronger and stronger the longer I'm away from here.
Your son was nine at the time that you write about in this book.
Mm-hmm.
One of the chapters is devoted to helping him pick out a Halloween costume. Why was that significant to you?
Well, I didn't help him pick out a Halloween costume. I forced him to wear my Halloween
costume.
He wanted
to go to Target and get something?
Right.
And you said you were too tired?
I was lazy. I was kind of lazy. And I had this great costume. I had had it sitting in my drawer for 20 years. I think I had worn it when I was in college. I'm a little embarrassed to say, but he was practically as big as me at that point. So I thought, oh, just try it on. You'll be you can be a jailbird. It was a prison costume. But he didn't really like that. So then I got this other idea. We had this fabulous kind of angel hat with kind of a Dr. Zeus affair. And I thought he could be a fallen angel. So I just made him a little sign that said Department of Corrections and the number on it and fallen angel.
That's witty.
I thought it was witty.
Did he like it?
He liked it at first, I think. But then, you know, when you have a kid, Halloween is the holiday of the year. It goes on for weeks, Halloween party. And I think by the last Halloween party, he just threw the fallen angel sign off and whatever. So,
well, Oakland is more of an urban situation than
mm-hmm.
what you left.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel, you said you feel more New England than ever. To some degree, is that because of those California things? For example, in one of the chapters, a stranger tries to recruit you to join the slow living movement.
Mm.
Is that like slow food?
Yeah, it is like slow food. You do everything very, very slowly, which for a New Englander is just, that's impossible, right?
Well, all of those people come to New York and walk in front of me and get me upset.
Right. Once I was in New York, this is actually a horrible story, but I was in a cab and somebody jaywalked. Very, very bad decision. The cab actually sped up to hit him. It was horrible. Horrible. So here, like really, you don't, if you cross the street, you know, and you're not walking with a light. But people hustle here, which is what I love. They hustle across the crosswalk. When you're in California, it is like a political act walking across the street.
My guest is Melanie Gideon. Her book, The Slippery Year, A Meditation on Happily Ever After, published by Knopf. You live in Food Central. You live in not far from where Alice Waters has her restaurant, but you admit to not being a foodie. Does that make you an anomaly in the Bay Area?
You know, I love to eat good food, but I'm not a foodie in that I don't love to cook.
You do have a connection to Julia Child.
Julia was good friends with my husband's grandmother. So I probably met her half a dozen times, and she came to my house once for dinner, which somehow I had forgotten. And I think the reason I had forgotten that was because I didn't make the dinner, because I wasn't allowed in the kitchen because, you know, I'm not a cook.
So your husband does the cooking?
My husband did do a lot of the cooking at that point, yes. And so he made pasta with lobster and maybe scallops, something like that. But I was in charge of the dessert, and I got her grape nut ice cream, and she loved it.
Before you wrote this, you wrote fiction. Has writing nonfiction affected the way you approach writing?
Let's see. I felt or feel a lot safer writing fiction, actually, than nonfiction, of course. I didn't anticipate feeling as vulnerable as I do, having written about my life and my husband and my son. Although I have to say, I describe this as kind of a tell-some memoir. It's not a tell-all memoir. I was very intentional about not wanting to trash the people in my family or overexpose them or my friends.
But people always ask about the autobiographical element of any work of fiction.
True.
Anyway.
Right.
I mean, you got to write total science fiction to get past
which
that.
I did write science fiction. That's how I got past it.
you write here about attending an author's panel at Book Expo America to promote a children's book that
right.
you'd written.
Right.
And you felt kind of marginalized?
Yeah, so this has mostly been my experience with being an author. I've written three books before this book. The last two were novels for young adults. And I at this book group expo, they have a couple of salons going on at once. So they have Salon A, Salon B, Salon C. I was in Salon B. And in Salon A were ZZ Packer, Andrew Sean Greer, and Sarah Gruen, who wrote Water for Elephants. And I was in Salon B discussing the lure of the young adult novel. So maybe there are about, I don't know, 20, maybe 40 people tops in our salon. And next door, there were hundreds and hundreds of people. And I could hear them through the walls laughing and clapping. And it was so excruciating because nothing like that was going on in my salon. And for me, it was just such a clear indication of kind of being at a B level. It was excruciating.
Well, you told an interviewer that you wondered if you had suffered enough or were different enough to write a memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Well, wasn't that painful enough?
It was painful, yeah, definitely, without a doubt.
But why do you think suffering is necessary to write a memoir?
Well, I did have to ask myself that question because most of the memoirs I had read did, you know, something very bad, something tragic had happened. And, you know, you'd suffered an abusive childhood or you had a horrible uncle or you were addicted to drugs. And that was not the case with me. You know, I had an okay life and I didn't want to write a book complaining. You know, I wanted to write a book about the good things, the ordinary things.
In fact, this memoir seems to be almost about life being too easy, and yet it still is a problem.
Yeah, I think it's about ennui. It's about kind of like we said, sleepwalking. And I think what I found for myself is that the way that I kind of snapped myself out of that sleepwalking state was to start to pay attention. And I found that absorption was really happiness for me. So if I could just focus on, say, the huge one-pound bag of Twizzlers I happened to be sharing with my son while we were driving someplace, that simple pleasure was, magnified. It just was, you know, all there was, really, all that mattered at the moment.
Well, I mentioned earlier that you got a very nice review from someone in the New Yorker. You've gotten only good reviews here, and that has to make you feel very good.
That's really nice.
But the one in the New Yorker said that she felt like she had just spent several hours knocking back drinks with an especially funny friend. This book took a lot longer than a few hours to write.
Mm-hmm.
So was that part of the problem for you, making it sound like it was just this casual, easy?
You know, this, I have to say, with this book, I suffered far less writing this book than I have with any other book. The other books were much tougher to write, and I think there was something about this voice. It was me that I wasn't willing to let surface. I kept it locked behind a door, and really until I was in my 40s. I think part of that was I wasn't willing to expose these parts of myself, and I wasn't I just took myself too seriously.
So where do you go from here? Back to fiction?
I don't know, actually. I'm contemplating a novel again, but I would like to write some more nonfiction because it's really fun.
The Slippery Year, A Meditation on Happily Ever After, is published by Knopf. My great pleasure to Melanie Gideon for being my guest today.
Thank you so much.